Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it.
Thanks again for joining us, folks. Here's our final segment, going global again in a broad way with my guest, Susan Schindehead from My World in New York City. How are you this morning, Susan?
Terrific. How are you?
Just couldn't be better. In fact, for our guests who may remember back in January, Susan was with us then to talk about the launch of her nonprofit. And here we are for the next segue and the next part of that journey. So let me give you a brief intro. Susan is a two-time New York Times bestselling author who moved from the spotlight of being the top human interest senior writer for People magazine, where she had access to over 43 million weekly readers, to start a remarkable new model for a humane form of capitalism. And I'm delighted to give voice to My World. Again, for those of you streaming, it's www.miworld.com. Susan's on a mission to open up the world, change the game of philanthropy across global borders by getting the stories of people in need connected to innovators and producers of the right products and services to improve their life. So tell us, how have things been going since we last connected with you back in January?
They keep rolling right along. They really do. Events in the world don't stop, and I think if anything, the interest in other parts of the world, and primarily in people in other parts of the world, is something that just continues to grow as new forms of technology begin to be more widely available. I think that what we're really seeing is more curiosity about places that we don't usually hear about.
Yeah, that's right. And so some of those stories that you've allowed to come out of their various pockets of the world, a couple that really, you know, come to mind for you in these past 9 or 10 months.
Well, we've launched a blog on the site as a way to kind of keep things rolling and be a little more current. And a friend of mine in New York mentioned that her sister had worked with Mercy Ships in Africa, which I knew something about. It was vaguely familiar. And I expressed an interest, and a little while after that, my friend forwarded me emails that her sister had sent home from Africa over about a 6-month period. And I edited them down. She had taken some really beautiful photographs of little kids who were in need of medical care and heard about the ship and were taken care of. And we start with one photograph of a little kid who had really severely bowed legs. He just really couldn't even walk. And by the end of her diary entries, he's putting on a new pair of high-top sneakers. And it was just a really kind of human and very personal account that I think, you know, people don't really hear too much. They make donations and they hear about institutions and charitable organizations, but when you really kind of slice that down to what the human-to-human contact is, I think the story becomes quite a bit more compelling. And we did a second piece that got quite a lot of attention. A young guy heard about My World on the internet, got in touch with me. It turned out that he had been in Pakistan last year after the floods that had displaced tens of thousands of people. And people here in the States were kind of tired of tragedy and hearing about disasters in other parts of the world. And he's a great kid. He's 23 years old. And he decided to go over there and see what he could do.
Mm-hmm.
So he was in a remote region north of Islamabad one night with some local Pakistanis in a jeep. And they'd been told not to stay out after dark, but one thing led to another. They were in some really flood-ravaged areas. And as they were coming back to Islamabad, he said, our worst nightmare, and out of the brush on either side of this remote dirt road came two gunmen wearing ski masks. One had a pistol and one had an AK-47. And they got the six guys out of the jeep, were screaming at them, pointing the guns, got them on their knees in execution position, and Ryan had his hands locked behind his head. And one of the gunmen fired an AK-47 right across the top of his head, you know. And he really thought that was the end. He really did. It was a terrifying moment. And all of a sudden, they were ushered back into their vans, told to get on their way. And Ryan turned to the translator and said, what were they screaming at us? Were they screaming that they were going to kill us and that they hated us? And his translator, through tears, said, no. He said what they were saying was, the floods came 3 weeks ago, and we've had no help from the government. We've had no help from NGOs. We have no food, and we have no water. And if we hadn't had guns, you wouldn't have stopped either. He said, this is what we're reduced to. This is what we have to do to feed our children. So I just thought that was kind of an interesting
Well, you talk about the power of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what it's all about. And, Susan, you know this yourself, of being, you know, doing feature writing from all sorts of venues for People magazine, that this having this lead, but that's also not just the great lead, it's how you're going to have, what you're going to land at the end of the story, right? This young man's message.
That's what I think. And back at People, we always used to say, once you had what we called the lead and the kicker, which was the opener of the story and then the ending, those are really the two most important parts of the story, because they create a narrative. You have to start at a starting point, and if you do storytelling the right way, you wind up in a place that hopefully has taken your reader on a little bit of a journey. So it's not the same as just throwing information out. I think storytelling has kind of come into its own, and everyone says, oh, I'm a storyteller, and we're going to do storytelling. And when I look at a lot of that material, what I tend to see is people who are just kind of throwing random information out. And that's not the same thing as really constructing a narrative and taking readers on a journey.
Well, particularly if you've got a message that you want them to carry in their heart.
Yeah, I think that's true. A friend of mine sent me a quotation that said, was something to the effect that if you tell me the facts, I'll learn, and if you explain it a little more, I'll remember. But if you tell me a story, then that will live in my heart forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I really do think, I mean, storytelling is one of the oldest things that exists. It's been around ever since human beings began. And I really do think that storytelling is the way that we not just know each other, but it's the way we know ourselves. I mean, if we look back at ancient cultures or the Maya, it's always, you know, what stories were told? What was folklore? What were the things that cultures and people thought were important to hand down? And as I see it, you know, we have so much information flying around now. I sometimes get worried that if we're not careful and if we don't aggregate that information, kind of sort it out and give a sense of what's important in all of this vast sea of information, I think we may tend to lose the point of what it is we're trying to convey.
Exactly. Or in particular, when you aggregate it or look at a series of stories, there are some other compelling messages and common threads that cut across all those stories.
That's what I think. And of course, with my world, you know, it's a global storytelling portal. And when I thought of how I'd like to do it, the first thing I thought was, well, you don't want to make it just another charity where, you know, there's this constant send money, feel bad, here's some sad stories. You know, that's what a lot of people tend to do. And I thought back to what my aunt, who was quite a successful children's writer, told me a long time ago. She said, Susan, if you're trying to engage someone emotionally as a writer, don't write about how hard someone's crying, she said. Write about how hard they're trying not to cry. And I think what that says is you try to emphasize the commonality among people, you know, the courage, the strength. You know, moms in other countries who really have very, very little in the way of material resources, but they want the same things that we do. They want to be able to take care of their kids and have food on the table and make a better life for their children. That's pretty universal. And I think that if you look at stories about other cultures and you kind of winnow it down to that, I just think you make it a lot more accessible for people in our part of the world.
And so that then when the donation connections start happening, people have a line of sight right to the heart. You know, there's this feeling, like you said, I said in the introduction, your desire is to connect the need with those who can provide. And that isn't necessarily just dollars, but it could be the type of products that would make sense, you know, appropriately scaled, appropriately engineered, manufactured, etc., for countries and places where there is so much need.
Well, that's what I thought. You know, having been in Pakistan myself and places like a remote mountain village in Guatemala, you know, when you really kind of get to know people in these places, I thought, well, wouldn't it be amazing if, say, you read a story about a little girl in Africa on our website, and it's not all about horror and war and terrible off-putting things, But maybe it's just the story of this little girl. Maybe she's an AIDS orphan. And you happen to notice that she's wearing a big pair of gunboat shoes that don't fit her very well. I don't know anyone who, if you gave them the opportunity to click a button on a computer and maybe chip in $5 to buy her a little pair of baby shoes and actually send them to her and know that they got to her and were received by her, I don't know anybody who wouldn't want to do that. And that's what we hope My World will allow people to do. It's not primarily a charity. We never use the word donate on the site because, you know, you don't donate gifts to your friends, you know, you don't. You can help somebody out or say hello to them or send them a letter of support or make a phone call, but it isn't always about having to give money and donate to people who have less than you do. And that's kind of what I'm trying to break away from with this website.
Well, essentially what you're trying to do is get people in relationship together. There's that opportunity because there's as much that that little girl with those new shoes, that smile will light up someone else's life across the planet with the opportunity to see that. Now, Susan, one of the things you and I had touched base on prior to our show was this whole conversation, though, how many people are using the web and social media and are thinking they're doing that within the confines of 140 characters.
Yeah, you know, I've dabbled in Twitter, and of course I'm on Facebook, and felt that I really had to learn these tools because of the project that I'm working on. But what seems to be happening in most cases, I think, is that when you're limiting communication to 140 characters, that doesn't really create human relationships. Twitter's been great, absolutely incredible, and it's a game changer in terms of getting out information of the uprising in Tahrir Square in Egypt, for example. You know, we could actually hear on the ground reports of what was going on, and that's something that's never really been possible before. But what I keep saying to people is, how many people in the Midwest in America, just an average person on the street, how many of those people really know someone who's living in Cairo? Do they have any Egyptian friends? Do they have any sense of what the people who live in Cairo are like, or what they do, or what their day-to-day life is like? And that, I think, is going to be the next challenge of what we do with the Internet and its capabilities. You know, I think it's a little bit false to make people think that they're now connected with the world just because they're on Twitter or Facebook. There's a guy named Ethan Zuckerman at the Berkman Center at Harvard who, for a while now, has been looking at this question, and what he's concerned about is that rather than the Internet being a great connector among disparate people, that what it really might do, if we're not careful, is just to kind of harden the walls between different cultures. Because people are people, and if you don't give them any outside stimulus, they tend to just talk to each other.
Yeah, I was going to say, and they're talking to those that are the same.
That's right. I heard Mark Zuckerberg not long ago, the Facebook founder, talk about where he sees Facebook going, and he just over and over and over again, he kept saying, well, now you can learn about music through your friends. Now you can find out movies through your friends. And I thought, well, that's kind of, is that really what we want to do, is just to keep on talking to people we already know who have the same tastes and values that we do? Or was the whole promise of the Internet to really kind of connect people who are very different?
Well, that story from the young man that was in Pakistan, you said that that story went up on your site, and in a short amount of time you had 1,000 hits.
Yeah, it was interesting. We posted the video in a couple of different places, and within 24 hours it had 1,000 hits rather on YouTube. And it was really interesting. The next morning on Facebook, I started getting friend requests from people with foreign-sounding names, and I thought, well, they must be friends of friends of mine. I didn't really know. And then I learned that our little story had been picked up by the largest news agency in Pakistan. And all of these kids were in places like Karachi, and they had read the story, and they were so touched by it that they tracked me down and were friending me on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, you know, Facebook, Twitter, all the social media really gives you a lot of capability, but I think we need something like a My World, a global aggregator portal that can kind of just show people things they don't know and perhaps lead them in new directions and in places that they might not otherwise have considered.
So the 9 months since we last spoke with you, whether it be my world specifically, but, you know, with the ongoing challenges around the world, are you seeing a sea change, though, in terms of more social entrepreneurship or different thought groups coming into the party along this idea of humane capitalism, as you call it?
Well, it's really interesting because I get into discussions with friends about, things like the Occupy Wall Street movement. And, you know, I've heard from a lot of people who say, well, the demonstrators don't really have a clear agenda, and they're a bunch of bums, and, you know, what are they really all about? And other friends and I say, well, you know, you may not see this as being very clearly articulated, but in terms of a sea change, I think it's pretty amazing that people are beginning to talk about issues like the global disparity in wealth. I don't remember that we had those conversations 10 years ago. You know, I haven't seen a kind of general feeling of unrest since maybe the Vietnam War. I mean, that was a very activist generation. And I, for one, thought, you know, kids of this generation weren't really interested in activism, that they weren't really looking at the world beyond their own front door. And to me, that's what has been so interesting about these Occupy movements and what we saw out of UC Davis, is that kids really do have an awareness about other parts of the world, and I think they're beginning to kind of look at a large picture on, is this, you know, from everything from the environment and climate change to the banking system and how we run the world.
Well, particularly as they reflect on what kind of choices they want to make in their life related to their career or their chosen field of study, or whether or not they're even going to pursue higher education.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, they're facing really, really tough choices. You know, to be saddled with the kind of debt that most kids have to incur just to get a higher education, which, of course, they're told they have to survive in this world. You know, that's a really tough plate that we're handing them. And I guess what's most heartening to me is to see that they're not all tuning out and dropping out and being all depressed about the state of the world. I think there's an awful lot of kind of inherent activism in these kids. I know because they find me. You know, they read about my world and they call me up. I think there's tremendous pent-up demand for human beings to connect with each other. And, you know, for a long time, this whole idea of how much money you had, that was, you know, that's how we kind of judged the world and judged other people. And now they're all facing kind of a common economic hardship. I mean, this, you know, the stuff that's happening economically isn't just us. It's not in one town or one part of the country. It's really a kind of new way that we have to look at the world, and it's a big picture. And I think for these kids to understand, well, you know, maybe we shouldn't be looking at all people and judging them only on how much money they have. You know, maybe there are other things that we can connect with, like through culture or music, you know, or things that they write.
Which, of course, then takes you back to, again, the mission of my world of connecting people in a much deeper and richer way. And to do that through the place of stories, which, again, can easily translate from one to the next. I mean, if anything, our stories actually probably are a lot more common than they are different.
That's what I think. I mean, I've talked, I remember talking to one of the lost boys of Sudan, you know, an amazing story about this kind of diaspora in Africa and people who were displaced. And here was this guy who was living in Minnesota. He left and was living in this totally foreign culture. And everyone was asking about the political travails in Africa. They were, you know, very formal questions about, well, what about the political parties and, you know, all of these things. And I remember just asking him, and I said, how did you learn that the war was coming? I mean, he was living in a remote African village without internet or TV or radio or anything. Mm-hmm. And he told this amazing story about how an elder was walking outside the village and a huge black crow came and landed on the elder's shoulder and said, you know, there is a disaster coming. Your people may be destroyed by fire or by war. Which is it that you prefer? And the elder ran back to the village. And I mean, you know, this was an amazing, fantastical story. I don't know how the word came to local villagers that a huge conflict was coming, but somehow that information had been cast in a way that that the elders knew, the village people could understand.
Could understand, exactly.
And I found it absolutely fascinating. But again, it was a story that was prompted by a question that I asked without all my Western baggage. You know, I didn't say, well, which political party did you support and what was the vote breakdown on your last national election? I just said, how did you hear that the war was coming? So, you know, it's just that, I think, with my world. It's just try to kind of have your ears open to what other cultures might be talking about. It's fascinating stuff, you know. It really is.
Just as much as it is for us to be mindful of listening what other generations are thinking about, too. Just within our own home place. Isn't that true?
Oh, yeah.
Susan, how can our listeners help you with My World at this point?
Well, you know, they can spread the word. They can come visit the beta site. We try to keep it updated. It's tough. I'm not funded or fully staffed right now, but we're always interested in hearing personal stories about your experience in other culture, the same way that we ran a blog post about a nurse on a mercy ship in Africa. If you have a really compelling story about what you've lived through and seen and your connection with other people, we'd love to hear from you. There's a place, the Contact Us section on the website that you can send messages to us. And also, we're, of course, on Facebook, as everybody. And voices of support are always great. If you want to come and hit the like button on our Facebook page, that's always terrific.
So, again, that's www.miword. Our guest today was Susan Schindehet. All the best, and we're going to catch up with you maybe another 9 months from now and watch this continue to progress.
I really appreciate it.
You bet.
Your work is terrific, and it's wonderful to know you're doing it.
Well, we're partners in the change crime on that one, aren't we, my friend?
Absolutely.
Very good. Thank you, Susan.
Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll-free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, helping others unleash potential through transformational change. 1-877-544-2580.